Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal. The first hour engineer today with Kyle Mabry and now taking over Mike Pritchard. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the French invasion of Egypt. This happened in 1798 when Napoleon Bonaparte took his troops into Egypt in what was an ultimately unsuccessful attempt to make Egypt a French colony. One interesting facet, however, of the French invasion is that in addition to taking tens of thousands of soldiers with him, Napoleon Bonaparte also took a group of intellectuals and scientists. It was a difficult experience. Not all of them survived, but those who did produced a 23-volume encyclopedia of all they had seen, and in the process, they founded a new science that would come to be called archaeology. In this part of Focus 580, we'll hear some of the story of this adventure as we talk with Nina Burley about her new book. It's titled Mirage, Napoleon's Scientists and the Unveiling of Egypt. Harper is the publisher of the book. And it's out in the bookstores now, and if you want to take a look at it, you can certainly go and see it. And for those people who are listening who have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. She's the author of two well-regarded books, The Stranger and the Statesman, James Smithson, John Quincy Adams, and The Making of America's Greatest Museum, The Smithsonian, and also A Very Private Woman, The Life and Unsolved Murder of Presidential Mistress Mary Meyer. She's contributed articles to a number of publications, including Time and The Washington Post, New York Observer, Red Book, and Chicago Tribune. She's also published on Salon.com and other publications. She's traveled quite a lot around this country covering American politics, and also she's traveled a lot in the Middle East reporting from inside Iraq during the 90s on assignment for Time. And one feature of her biography I definitely want to make sure that I mention, she has a master's degree in public affairs reporting from the University of Illinois at Springfield. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased to have her as guest. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Ms. Burley, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
So you were actually born in Chicago.
I was, and I spent a lot of my early years in journalism in Springfield, so I know Central Illinois like the back of my hand.
Very good. And I'm just curious now, when you were there, was it still Sangamon State University?
It was.
All right.
Yeah, that was in the dark ages, huh?
Well, there is someone very near and dear to me who is a graduate of that program. So I think all you Sangamon State grads should be very proud of having graduated.
It was a wonderful program, and I recommend it to all the young journalists here I meet in the university here in New York.
Yeah. Well, let us go back to that time and talk a little bit, perhaps to start, about the French motivation here. What was it that led the French to take these troops to sail through the Mediterranean and to launch this ultimately ill-fated attempt to colonize Egypt?
Well, you have to picture the time. It's 200 years ago. It's the dawn of kind of the modern era, the dawn of the global economy. And the European nations are fighting each other, especially England and France, all over the world for control of colonial territories. That's the first thing. That's the backdrop. They're fighting for these far-flung bits of land to enrich themselves. And then the second thing that was going on is, In 1789, the French had their revolution, and this is only about 9 years later. The French government was very unstable. They had gone through the terror. The revolution had been very bloody. The civil services in Paris were just non-existent. The city smelled worse than it had during the Middle Ages. They needed a leader, and who came on the scene but this 28-year-old man you know, 5 foot something, named Napoleon Bonaparte, a Corsican, a commoner, and kind of the perfect leader. He was like a rock star to them, the perfect leader for the post-revolutionary era. He had pacified all of these countries in Europe were fighting against the French at this point because the royals in these European countries were terrified and did not like what was happening in France. They had killed their king. So they were fighting the French on all sides, and Napoleon had managed to lead the French army into Italy and basically take over Italy and so they brought back all of these wonderful treasures to the what would become the Louvre. And so the French have this post-revolutionary moment. They have kicked their clerics out of France. France had long been Catholic, and Catholic priests had basically run the education system. They had been the intellectuals. They were gone. So the education system was beginning to look, or was a prototype of what we now know to be sort of secular education. But in this extremely radical post-revolutionary period in France, the scientists had kind of stepped into this role of spiritual advisors to the country. And they had some of the greatest scientists living in Europe at the time were in Paris. These men were calculating theories that are still taught in modern calculus. A geometer who went along on this expedition named Monge had basically, when he was a young man, theorized about a way to draw geometric, do math on paper, basically, draw shapes on paper mathematically, and it became known as descriptive geometry, which enabled the Industrial Revolution to happen because designers of machinery used this system. The naturalists who were living in France at this time were theorizing proto-evolutionary theories. And these were all men who ended up basically going on this expedition.
Mm-hmm. You know, sir, among the many things you can say about Napoleon Bonaparte, he was someone who had a high regard for science and scientists. And so he had this idea that he would bring this group of some of the best and brightest of France along with him. Now, at the same time, though, I think his idea was that they were there as part of the engine of colonization. I think they had a different idea. Their idea was they were going for in the cause of science.
Exactly. I mean, certainly Napoleon was going to use them to colonize, and they did administer. They did do things. They did help him set up, especially when the ships, his equipment was all blown up in Aboukir Bay, and they no longer had any communications line to France, which happened quite early after they invaded Egypt. He used them to keep the army going. He had an inventor along, this brilliant man named Nicolas Conté, who had enabled them to build all sorts of tools and machinery that they had lost, and even make things like cloth for their uniforms. But the scientists themselves really wanted to explore. They had the kind of Enlightenment era, skeptical way of looking at the world. Let's see what everything looks like, and let's examine it closely, and let's experiment on it. And so they brought this mentality, this sort of secular, scientific, speculative way of looking at the world to the Sahara Desert and to this country that had essentially not been examined like that ever.
And that's, I guess, again, sort of an important point here to make about just why it is, how significant this was, is that at this point, 1798, probably for the previous couple of centuries, there had been almost no contact and interaction between Europe and the Islamic world. So virtually from the Crusades up to this point, there almost no Europeans had traveled
right
in the Middle East.
That's right. Europeans had no information other than what a few straggling merchants and maybe travel writers and a few religious people had brought back from this part of the world, and it wasn't good. It wasn't a good image. They knew that there were these colossal relics in this country, and they had kind of a classical viewpoint, a classical being what the Greeks and the Romans had told in their books about these ruins. They had that idea of what they were. They had no modern understanding of the ancient Egyptian civilization. And, of course, the Romans and the Greeks had come along when the Egyptian civilization was already very old. And so the Romans and the Greeks also didn't understand anything about why these pyramids were there and what these ruins, these colossal columns and statues meant. So these scientists in the 1800 are basically reading Herodotus and trying to figure out, using Herodotus as their travel guide, written thousands of years before they got there.
And certainly it's also true that the people who were living in Egypt at the time didn't have any better idea of their heritage than anybody else did. They couldn't, when the European scientists got there and started looking around, obviously they couldn't read the hieroglyphics that were on the monuments and left behind, but neither could nobody.
That's right.
Could.
The hieroglyphic script, which is the key to understanding what the pyramids are and what those temples along the Nile were and those statues and their system was all about, had not been decipherable for over 1,500 years when the scientists arrived. And this picture script was on everything in Egypt. The Arabs, who inhabited Egypt at this point, thought that this script was alchemical, and that they were mystical symbols, and that if only somebody could regain that lost knowledge, that these symbols would do things like turn lead into gold or bring the dead back to life. And the Europeans also believed this. And our word alchemy actually comes from the Arabic word alkeme, which means Egyptian things or Egyptian matter.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, so I wanted to do that. And, of course, we'll continue to talk with Nina Burley. Her book, which is just out, is titled Mirage, Napoleon's Scientists and the Unveiling of Egypt. She's been journalist for a long time. She's covered American politics. She's familiar here with this part of the country. She went to school in Springfield when the university there was a Sangamon State. She's also studied at University of Chicago. She now writes for People magazine. She's a staff writer in New York covering human interest stories. She's also an adjunct professor of journalism at Columbia University. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to talk with, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had a couple of comments and a question. Recently, the St. Louis Museum of Art did an exposition on the Napoleonic trip to Egypt, and part of the exhibit were things that were later made in France. Clothing and furniture and all sorts of things with European, with Egyptian themes. So it became a very popular in first in France and then I think also in England and maybe other places as well. This discovery of these Egyptian monuments had a very big influence on popular culture. So I think that's very interesting. And then my question is that while I was visiting this exhibit in St. Louis, I purchased a copy of the plates from the encyclopedia that was done by the Napoleonic scientist, the Description de l'Egypte, and it was put out by Taschen, and it was like all of the plates, but it didn't include any of the text, and I'm wondering if there is any, not going to a rare book room somewhere, any way to find the text to the Description de l'Egypte?
That's a good question. I used that Taschen, actually, when I was writing this, because it shows all the illustrations. But you're right. There are tens of thousands of pages of text which are not included in it. They couldn't possibly be because it's a 24-volume encyclopedia. And to be honest with you, I don't know of any modern version of that, certainly not in English. Now, there may be some in France. I did the research in France and had assistants in Paris who were using the old texts. And I don't think we ever came across a new version of it, partly because what these guys brought back in terms of information, it's almost more useful to historians who want to study what Egypt was like then than it is to sort of anyone who wants to know anything about Egypt now, because these guys, and this is one of the sort of eccentric aspects of this whole thing, they didn't really understand what they were looking at all. The hieroglyphic script, they found the Rosetta Stone, which is their great find. They found this stone in the dirt, and they handed it over to an engineer. Found it, and the scientist right away knew this was like this major important thing. It had three scripts: the hieroglyphic, the Demotic Egyptian, and the Greek. They knew that this was going to be the key to figuring out what this all meant, but it wasn't translated or deciphered for another 20 years. So while they were there, they didn't know what they were looking at, and they also didn't really know what to make of the people, the inhabitants of Egypt, these people, the Islamic people who were living there, the Arabs, and basically it was a very polyglot place. Cairo had, because it was part of the Ottoman Empire, it had Albanians running around, and Greeks, and Christian Greeks, and Jews, and black Africans, but it was mainly Arab, and it was ruled by this strange caste, former slave caste, the warrior fighting caste of Islam for 1,000 years. These guys called the Mamelukes, who were Caucasian fighting men, kidnapped or purchased as boys and brought up in these Islamic compounds as Orthodox religious men with superior equestrian fighting skills, and they ruled Cairo at this point. So it was a very strange place, extremely religious, and had not had a scientific tradition. The Arabs had a scientific tradition, obviously, in Baghdad
How about Alexandria?
If you read my book, when they arrive, that's where they landed. They're on the boats. They're 50,000 soldiers and sailors, and about 150 French scientists, and only a few of them knew where they were going when they got on the boats. This was another eccentric aspect of this whole thing. Napoleon managed to keep it secret. The French government did not want the British to know that this flotilla was sailing across the Mediterranean because they knew the British had the superior navy. And so it was entirely secret until 2 or 3 days off the coast of Alexandria. Now, when they were told, the scientists were extremely excited about this right away because, you know, Alexandria, the seat of classical learning, the library of the Ptolemies, you know, they had their library on board and they were consulting it. And here's Herodotus telling them about these beautiful temples. And so they get into the bay of Alexandria and they start looking through their telescopes, and all they see is this ruins, this desiccated, not even ruins, just a place with huts and a couple of crumbling walls. And far in the distance, a massive column, which is what we call Pompey's Column. It was the last remnant of this what at one time had been a gargantuan classical pagan temple, which had been destroyed by the Christians, I think, or around early in the millennium. And so this is what they're seeing. They're looking out and they're seeing this. Oh my God! This is where we've been headed, and what is this place? It's not what it was.
Oh, well, this is very fascinating. I'm going to have to get your book. And one more little point is that because of this discovery, I believe, that the director of antiquities for all of Egypt for the next 100 years was always a Frenchman.
Was always what?
It was always French, she says.
Yes, they left They definitely left cultural people in charge there, and the Egyptians very much had had a relationship with the French for years afterwards. I mean, they kept their street signs in Cairo. Even though the French were only there for 3 years, the street signs in Cairo, well into the 1980s, were still written in Arabic and French. So there was a lot of French influence that lasted through the years, even though the English ended up inhabiting it. Now, just I wanted to make one point, that what you brought up earlier about the influence on Europe after these guys came back with their haul of collections, their knowledge. Basically, they came back with notebooks and specimens. They were unable to bring the large things back because the British, who they had surrendered to, took the big stuff. So that's why the Rosetta Stone is in the British Museum and not in Paris right now. But their book, the Description de l'Egypte, with its beautiful drawings of all things Egyptian, from insects to the colossal relics, it so influenced and so fascinated Europe that there was this craze that for the next 50 years, they call it Egyptomania. And tea sets, architecture, clothing, furniture, everything. People just had Egyptian stuff on the mind, and it was there. It was the way people, they lived in this Egypt-drenched kind of style or craze for many years, and it also kicked off the European desire to have these large objects and to see them. So because the Industrial Revolution had now enabled them to hydraulically drag gigantic things across sand and onto boats, that is why we have the obelisk in Central Park, the obelisk in Paris, all the mummies and sarcophagi in all these museums around the world, in Britain, France, Germany, and New York. Because this book whetted the appetite of the Europeans for Egyptian things.
Hmm. Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And our guest is Nina Burley. Her new book is Mirage, Napoleon's Scientists and the Unveiling of Egypt. It's published by Harper, and the book's just out now, and it indeed tells the story of the Egyptian experience with the invasion of the French, and really concentrates on the fact that not only did Napoleon bring tens of thousands of soldiers in this attempt to conquer and colonize Egypt, but he also brought with him a number of scientists who spent a lot of time observing and making drawings and bringing back material, and that this was really the first significant contact between Europeans and the Islamic world for a couple of hundred years, and was very much the beginnings of the field of archaeology. Again, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller here to talk with in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Nina, this is a fascinating story. But I'm also very interested in finding out what personally motivated you to do the initial research and what got you, very involved in stuff like that. But what was the triggering mechanism that made you want to do this research?
Sure. Well, first of all, I was living in France, just finishing up the book on James Smithson, the founder of the Smithsonian, who was this quirky little French British chemist who lived most of his life in France because he was a bastard son of the Duke of Northumberland and had basically been exiled from the social world of England. Many of his colleagues were these men, or he knew these men. So that's how I found out about them. And I just thought, it was 2003, the Iraq War was just percolating, just beginning to become inevitable, and it was early in that spring, and I thought, this is such an important part of history, this interaction between this early interaction between Western civilians, European intellectual scientific civilians, and the Islamic world. And I want to know more about this. You know, I think that we live in a time when we should try to know more about that part of the world. And for me, I just feel that, and as I write in the book early on, that part of the world to us is like the dark side of the moon. The way that they look at the world, the way that the Islamic world, the Middle East, and the what they used to be called the Orient, the way they look at themselves and history is much different than the way we look at ourselves and our history. They learn a different kind of history. They learn about the Silk Road and Muhammad, and they don't learn about it from our point of view. And it really is, the fact that these guys went over there really to learn about and not to invade and attack, but to learn about and to bring back information. I just thought that was something to be honored. And I wanted to know more about it. That was one reason. And the other is, it's just this great adventure story. I mean, they are the first Indiana Joneses. These are they're out there. They've got spectacles, notebooks, and pens. And they run out of pencils quite soon, and they start using spent bullets that they stick into reeds to make their drawings. They're out there in the desert. They're collecting insects and plants and bits and pieces of this and that, and putting them in cases while there's a war going on around them, and a very atrocious war. I mean, the French were, first of all, very brutal to the Egyptians, and then the Egyptian climate was horrendous for them to be in. Bubonic plague was endemic, and soldiers who caught it died of it at an alarming rate. 10 of 12 who caught it died within 24 or 48 hours. They had no immunity to it. And then the British and the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, who nominally owned Egypt, were not happy about the French being there. So they're coming down from, the British are on the water, and the Ottomans are coming down from the north. And it was a very difficult place to be. And so these guys are running around, and they're still, what they're fascinated with is, why does the Sphinx, what does that mean? And how much, what kind of stone is it made of? And how big is it? And let's climb to the top of Pompey's Pillar and measure it. And let's make sure that we get every one of those electrical fish that live in the Mediterranean. Let's make sure we get a specimen of every one of those to take home. And by the end of their 3 years there, they had crates of stuff. And the French soldiers, who didn't like them being along in the first place for various reasons, partly because Napoleon was so close to them and they were jealous, but also because they had to protect them on their missions, on their finding missions, which they resented. By the end of the 3 years there, the French soldiers were almost as dangerous to the scientists as the enemy, because they thought, first of all, the French soldiers badly wanted to be back in France. They were sick of being in this country. They knew they were losing. It was an invasion that was doomed to fail, and Napoleon had already left them there. That's a whole other part of the story. But they're looking at the scientists, and they're seeing these piles of crates, and they're saying, "You people have treasure, and we've been stuck here in the desert, in this fly-specked nowhere, with bubonic plague stalking us. And you've been collecting treasure. What's in those boxes?" And they were under serious danger to protect their findings from their own soldiers at the end.
Also, one other question. Do you happen to know if your book's available locally here in Champaign yet?
It should be. I mean, the big bookstores had ordered it, And Barnes & Noble, I think, had, and I know the independent bookstores were ordering it, but I'm not sure if it's in the stores right this minute, but it should be within a week if it's not there now.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I would think that since the official publication date was the end of last month, I would think that it would be in the bookstores, but...
Sure. Yeah, it probably is. I mean, it certainly is in the bookstores here in New York, and I was in Chicago last week visiting my family, and I know I saw it there.
Yeah. You talked earlier about the fact that when the fleet with the soldiers and the scientists and Napoleon left that they didn't, only a small number of people knew where they were going. And it was only when they were virtually within sight of land did they find out where it was they were going. And it seems that, and this is surprising given Napoleon's reputation as a military commander, that they weren't very well prepared for the conditions that they would encounter. At least, you know, he led his troops into the desert wearing winter uniforms, and they very quickly found out that that was going to be a problem. How, for the scientists, and apparently they, like the soldiers, they didn't know where they were going either. How well prepared were they for the conditions that they would experience when they got there?
Well, they weren't prepared for it any more than the soldiers were. I mean, they learned. They had a different situation, though, because Napoleon didn't make them march across the Sahara Desert for 5 days in alpine wool uniforms without canteens, which is what he did to his men when they landed. He left his scientists on the boat, on a boat, and then brought them in to Cairo by water later. And, of course, once they got there, they were lodged like kings because the French had chased away. They quickly dispatched the Mamelukes. The Mamelukes were fascinating cultural relics of another time, and they weren't up to the French army. They weren't up to that task. So they ran off, and they left these fabulous palaces behind, empty in Cairo. And Napoleon, of course, he loved his scientists. He said to them, pick whichever one you want, and that'll be where you house your institute. So they found the biggest one, and they moved in, and it had a 30-acre courtyard or grounds, and, you know, beautiful orange and lemon trees, bubbling fountains, lapis lazuli tile, just what you would imagine, you know, the kind of a Kublai Khan fantasy of a building. And they move in, and it's fantastic at first. They set up their institute meeting room in the old harem quarters. So here they are, you hear these scientists in their frock coats, and they're having these meetings, and they're talking about, you know, the optical theory behind the mirage, which none of them had ever seen before. And two of the scientists, the heads of the commission, actually did go on that horrendous march with Napoleon, but they rode on horses ahead of the men, and they weren't paying attention to the men and their suffering. They were looking ahead at this strange thing on the horizon, that this phenomenon that they'd never seen before, this water, but it really wasn't water. And what was driving the men mad in the ranks was fascinating, the geometer. And he's stopping, and every once in a while he would stop and draw this, you know, this optical diagram, this geometric diagram of what must be happening with the sun and the land to make this happen. And so they weren't prepared for the heat any more than the men were, but they were experiencing it in a different way. And I think some of them didn't like Egypt at all after some time there. But they initially, all of them were extremely excited to be there because this was an undiscovered land, and undiscovered in many ways, and had a completely unknown, ancient, fascinating civilization to be deciphered, to be documented, measured, examined, and they were totally excited to be there in the beginning. But they also faced the hardships. I mean, they lived in a palace, but after a certain amount of time, you know, they basically lived, all of them ended up living like Egyptians because they had no, their French, the supply line was gone. I mean, their supplies were gone very early on, actually. They lost all their equipment in the bay. They're shipwrecked. Even before the British came and blew up the rest of the fleet, the scientist's ship full of stuff wrecked. The scientists were no longer on it. It crashed against a rock. And they were left with, you know, to their own devices. And that's why they were using spent bullets, to write with.
Well, as you said, the French troops had success on land against the Mamelukes, so that wasn't a particularly problem for them. But it was not that long after they got there that the French fleet was completely crushed by Nelson at the Battle of the Nile. So it must have felt to these people, particularly the scientists, that they had almost as if they were marooned there.
Utterly marooned. The last the last, and of course, see, they had set up their scientific institute in Cairo to mimic the French Institute, the Grand Institute de France, of which they were all members, and they were meant to communicate with that mother institute and send back, like, reports and so on. And the last report that they sent to them was about the Rosetta Stone. They actually made copies of it and sent it, paper copies of it back to Europe, which, of course, excited the Europeans greatly. But once that was their last communication, and that was within the first year. After that, they had no communication. They didn't know if their families were alive. They didn't know what was happening scientifically, all sorts of scientific developments. This was a period of great turmoil in European politics because, of course, this is the beginning of this revolutionary period, but also in science. The revolutionary time and scientific discoveries in Europe kind of coincided, which is one reason I find this era very fascinating. Mm-hmm. They were discovering electricity. They were just starting to realize how old the Earth really was, not 6,000 years old, as the clerics had told them, but perhaps many, many, many millions of years old. They were discovering, they were beginning to intuit how life began and what linked all of the living creatures on this earth. These were things that they were trying to understand because they, you know, the clerical kind of cloak over learning had been stripped away, and so they had, you know, they were approaching things much differently. And so here they are out in the desert, and all of these things were happening in Europe, and they didn't know anything about it until they got back.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus, maybe a little bit more. Just very quickly, I want to introduce again our guest, Nina Burley. She's the author of a new book that tells this story that we've been talking about the French invasion of Egypt and the scientists who went along. The book is Mirage, Napoleon's Scientists and the Unveiling of Egypt. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, the number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Probably the single most significant thing that the French found, at least in terms of opening up the culture of the ancient Egyptians, would indeed be the Rosetta Stone, because it had the same text in three languages. It had it in Greek, which they could read, and it had it in Egyptian hieroglyphics, which they couldn't. And this was the thing that opened up the possibility to read the inscriptions that was on everything. It was all over everything there from the ancient Egyptians. Setting aside that, what would have been some of the other significant discoveries, things that they found, things that they learned there?
That's a good question. I mean, they did bring back other insects and objects of ancient objects. One of the scientists, for example, was dissecting an electric fish that he found in the Mediterranean. And he'd been working on kind of these theories of what, you know, links all life together, the organic system. They'd been classifying life, and now they were trying to figure out, like, why everything had arms and legs, or, you know. And so this man was looking at this electric fish, and he had this moment of kind of the Eureka moment, and he thought he had discovered this mystical, magical kind of fluid that connected all living creatures. He discovered it through this electric fish. And he went back and wrote a paper about the unity of life, which in some ways, even though it was way off base, and it was almost closer to kind of spiritualism and mesmerism, which was also a strain that was coming into vogue in Europe in the 1820s or so. But it did kind of precede, it put people into thinking about what Darwin eventually discovered or theorized, that animals had morphed over time. And that was one thing. They found new kinds of plants and animals. I mean, I think the main thing is that they brought back to Europe a knowledge, or, you know, not maybe not knowledge or an understanding, but images of this other part of the world that people had not really spent much time in, and it really inspired Europeans to know more about it. And they did definitely bring back more information about the Islamic world. Now, whether that was accurate information and whether it, you know, improved relations between those two parts of the world, I think is debatable, and it actually is debated, and many people think that they were just the flying wedge of colonialism. Edward Said, for example, in his book Orientalism, takes them to task because they really had a kind of a secular, you know, European instinctive discomfort with the Islamic world at this point, because at this point the Islamic theologians are the closest thing they have to science in that part of the world, and they have not been studying the world the way the scientists of Europe had been. For example, the scientists were trying to show them things like, look, we can do electrical experiments, see, we can shock you, and we can put balloons up in the air and men can fly. Isn't this amazing? And the Islamic theologians and the intelligentsia of Cairo were totally unimpressed by this. And the French could not understand it. And they thought, what is wrong with these people? They don't, you know, they're not curious. And for the Islamic theologians, it was, you know, Allah has told us there are many, many things in the world, and we don't need to know any more than that. So they were kind of, to the European eyes, they were complacent, inscrutable, you know, all those words, mm-hmm. lazy. And from the Muslim point of view, from the, you know, Islamic point of view, the Europeans were just behaving like pigs, and they had, you know, they soiled and desecrated mosques, and especially the soldiers. And so there was this kind of a big, big chasm in terms of understanding each other that these guys didn't really bridge, but they did bring back a picture of what it was like. And, you know, it was what the Europeans did with that picture is they fantasized with it. And that's kind of why my book is called Mirage, for one reason, because these scientists discovered, one of them, the basically first theorized what the mirage was, fact, but also kind of in a more, I guess, symbolic way, the way that we look at the Middle East has, you know, this word, mirage comes from the French word to look at, mirer. The way that we look at the Middle East, even today, but especially then and after they came back, is kind of unreal. We don't really know what we're seeing. And, you know, neither do they, I think, understand us, but we definitely don't know how they think.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, fun to read the descriptions of the reaction of the people, at least there locally, when the French landed. The French were stunned that the local people seemed not to be particularly impressed by the French.
It's a great scene.
You know, as if 50,000 troops landed on your beach
right.
every day, the people just looked at them and said, like, well, yeah, whatever, and went on with their life. And certainly the French expected a different kind of reception. You wonder, at least among the intelligentsia, though, among the intellectual caste, whether this experience with Egypt and what they brought back, did it have any sort of an impact on, let's say, the European world view? Did they think any differently about their place in the world, or did that really not change?
Did the Europeans think differently?
Yes, did the Europeans think differently about themselves and about the world?
That's a good question, and I think that they probably thought No, I think it probably made them more desirous of making a claim to this place. I don't know that it, and probably made them feel more superior in some ways, because the French certainly didn't bring back, these guys didn't bring back a picture of the Egyptians that would lead any European at that time to think, oh, aren't they smart? You know, it was more, this ancient stuff is so cool. Can we have it? And I think it was more about that and more about staking a claim than kind of teaching them a great deal of a great deal about, say, how the Islamic world looked at, because they were unable to decipher what was happening. I mean, the scientists learned more about the way the modern Egyptians lived, but I think the European reaction to it was much more in to be more interested in the classical civilization of Egypt at the time.
It must have you'd have to put yourself in the position of these people, and just like anyone, the first time you see pictures, or if someone was actually lucky enough to go, it is extremely cool. It's mind-bogglingly cool to see what remains of Egyptian civilization, and you just put yourself in the position of these people who hadn't, I'm sure, just never seen anything like it before, probably didn't really know what to make of it, wandering around and looking at these things like the pyramids and the Sphinx and all of the other things that remain of ancient Egyptian culture.
Right. I mean, you have to picture the scale of this stuff. Even today, when you go back as a modern person, I live in New York City with tall buildings all around me. You go there and you're standing there on the sand, and these things are just gigantic. You know, they're just massive. The pyramids are like man-made mountains, and you have to. And we now know how to raise tall buildings and skyscrapers, but then they didn't do that in 1800. They had no idea. So they didn't know what manner of men had done this. And, you know, it was like almost like going to another planet. You know, they were like astronauts or something. They're looking at this. This stuff testifies to something that they can't understand, that has, you know, that's very ancient. And, of course, again, this is a period where they've just come out of believing that the world's only 6,000 years old. So they know it's older, but they have no idea how old this is, and they don't know whether this stuff was put there by people who actually knew some, you know, superstitious being that we're you know, not in touch with anymore. I mean, a lot of them thought this, and still, I mean, you still find people who believe in pyramid power, but even then, a lot of them thought, you know, the ancient Egyptians were in touch with mystical, magical power. And I think these guys, they were not, they weren't believers in that kind of thing, but they were still just stunned by it. And they would walk, they would go on these marches at night because it was too hot to travel during the day. So they'd be marching up the Nile with the soldiers, and in the moonlight, there are these descriptions of them coming around a curve, a bend in the river, in the silver water whispering by, and all of a sudden they see in the moonlight this massive ancient temple that just towers hundreds of feet in the air, and it's in the middle of nowhere. And they would just stop, and, you know, whole regiments would just put their arms down and stare at it in the moonlight. It was that moving.
Where can one say, and unfortunately we're down to the last minute or so here or two, can one say that for the people who went on this trip, the scientists were talking about, this was a kind of a life-changing experience?
Utterly life-changing. None of them came back the same as they had left. Professionally, in terms of their intellectual, their theories, the way they thought of things, some of them came back, like the physicist came back and studied heat and wrote great papers about the properties of heat. This person I mentioned before, involved with evolution and organic biology, came back and had this theory about the unity of all life, which he would never have gone off on. He was off the rails, according by the standards of the Parisian scientists. Many of them had their health permanently disabled. One man, one of the naturalists who drew most of the drawings of the insects, lost his sight mysteriously about 10 years later. He was obsessively drawing the jaws of these biting insects over and over again, also studying sort of proto-evolutionary theories, and he started to go blind. And he couldn't, but basically, he could no longer bear sunlight, and he had to wear a steel mask and a black net around his face for the last 20 years of his life. He couldn't even see his own drawings. And the doctors at the time could only theorize that he picked something up in the desert that had a sort of a latent effect on his eyesight. And every one of them, for the rest of their lives, they would meet annually, and they called themselves the Egyptians, and they would debate and argue intensely over what they had seen. Some of them never accepted the actual decipherment of the hieroglyphics. Some of them never accepted the way that they were deciphered. And to the rest of their days, they believed certain things about the hieroglyphics that were wrong.
Well, we're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of the time. It's a great story, and if people want to read it, you should look for the book. It's Mirage, Napoleon Scientists and the Unveiling of Egypt. It's published by Harper, by our guest Nina Burley, who currently is a staff writer at People magazine. She lives in New York, writes about human interest stories. She is also adjunct professor of journalism at Columbia University and has contributed to a lot of other publications. Her work has appeared in places like Time and People, Washington Post, New York Magazine, and a lot of others. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome, and thank you, and Happy New Year.
Thanks to you as well. Support for our program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information available on the web at infantparent.com. That's it for us here on Focus 580, but of course, we hope that you will stay tuned. Coming up next, it's the afternoon magazine. Celeste Quinn is off again today, and I'm not sure who's hosting the show. Tom Rogers, I'm told. Here you go, Tom. Take off.
That would be me. And thanks for passing it over on this last day before the Christmas holiday for a lot of us. On the Friday show today, we'll have an archive from the AM 580 Afternoon Magazine Library. Robert Thurman, a scholar, author, and former Tibetan Buddhist monk, will talk to Celeste in the next hour. He's the director of the Tibet House in New York City, and he has a book called Infinite Life, Seven Virtues for Living Well. And that's coming up in the next hour, or the next couple of hours of the Afternoon Magazine, with a look at news from NPR, the BBC, and AM 580. Now let's take a look at the weather. We're going to do a little switch here because we're having a bit of a technical problem with our computers. We'll hopefully get the commodity prices up in a second. But in the meantime, the weather forecast includes a dense fog advisory for western and central Illinois to extreme northwest Indiana through the afternoon. Our